This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 7th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Elephants and Art. We're listening to a track called Bathing in the River by the Thai Elephant Orchestra. The elephants, and this is no joke, the elephants were directed by elephant conservationist Richard Lair and composer David Soldier.
It's a group of elephants who are being helped to make money for their own preservation by recording and performing, and they have a couple of CDs out, and I've enjoyed mine very much.
That's Sarah Lindsay, whose poem Hollow Boom Soft Chime, the Thai Elephant Orchestra, was in Poetry Magazine last year and featured on the Poetry Magazine podcast. Let's first listen to her read the poem, and then I'm going to call Sarah Lindsay and talk a bit more about elephants and about animals more generally. Here's the poem.
Hollow boom, soft chime, the Thai Elephant Orchestra. A sound of far-off thunder from instruments 10 feet away. Drums, a log, a gong of salvage metal. Chimes of little Isan bells, pipes in a row, sometimes a querulous harmonica. Inside the elephant orchestra's audience, bubbles form of shame and joy and burst. Did elephants look so sad and wise, a tourist thinks, her camera cold in her pocket, before we came to say they look sad and wise? Did mastodons have merry, unwrinkled faces? Hollow boom, soft chime, stamp of a padded foot, tingle of Renat, rattle of Anklung. This music pauses sometimes, but does not end. Pratida gently strokes the bells with a mallet. Pung and his mahout regard the gong. Paitun sways before two drums, bumping them, keeping time with her switching tail. Sales of recordings help pay for their thin enclosure of trampled grass. They have never lived free. Beside a dry African river, their wild brother lies, a punctured balloon, torn nerves trailing from the stumps of his tusks. Hollow boom, soft chime, scuff of a broad foot, sometimes rarely a blatting elephant voice. They seldom attend the instruments without being led to them, but, once they've begun, often refuse to stop playing.
Hello, this is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. This is Curtis. How are you?
Hi, Curtis. How are you?
Good. So we just listened to your poem, Hollow Boom Soft Chime, the Thai Elephant Orchestra. And in 2009, you won the J. Howard and Barbara M.J. Wood Prize from the Poetry Foundation, and it was a $5,000 award. Would you tell us what you did with some of that money?
I went to a website that features paintings that have been done by elephants and are sold to help contribute to the welfare of the elephants in Thailand. And I bought one of the paintings.
What painting did you buy, and which elephant was it by, and what does it look like?
The painter is named Nam Chok, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's a fairly young elephant, or at least he was at the time, and was considered the enfant terrible.
The elephant terrible.
School, exactly. The school of painting in which he does abstract. Some of the elephants are actually taught to imitate the gestures of their companions and create outlines of elephants and flowers, but this one is an energetic abstract with bright green and bright red paints.
And would a casual observer be able to tell that it's painted by an elephant and not a human being?
The casual observer would have to have a lot more art training than I would, at least. I wouldn't have been able to tell.
In the July-August issue of Poetry, you wrote a little essay about these elephants, these painting elephants. Now, so obviously you have a big interest in elephants, not only that poem, but that essay. Why elephants in particular?
I think it started very simply because they are considered a sort of symbolic animal for memory. And I've been trying to write about memory and the burden of memory. They seem to be beasts of burden with a certain sadness. And I think that's one of the effects of having a lot of past, being very much aware of your past life or your family's past life.
Yeah, there's a deep strain of melancholy in your poem, Hollow Boom, Soft Chime, the Thai Elephant Orchestra. It celebrates the fact that these animals can actually make music, pleasing music, obviously.
Yes.
But there's a melancholy in that they're in this situation to begin with.
Yes, the elephants don't really have a choice of living in a natural wild situation. People have taken over most of the area.
Yeah.
And elephants, many of them were teak logging animals or the descendants of those.
Mm.
And teak logging with animals is now not an industry anymore. They've used up most of the forest. So the animals are out of work.
But it's more than just elephants, I think, that interest you, because there's a lot of animals in a lot of your poems.
Yeah.
What is it that animals bring out about our humanity for you in your poetry?
It's partly about the animals bringing out our humanity and telling us things about ourselves by being like us. But what interests me even more is the ways that they're not like us and being able to get away, say, from the way my own mind works to the extent that I can, and trying to get into the mind of something else that doesn't think the way I do at all.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think when the elephants make music and when they paint, the poem suggests that they're kind of into it. They're reluctant at first, but then they get into it. And then in your essay in poetry about the painting elephants, they seem to get into it as well. What do you think goes on in an elephant's mind when they're making art? Is it something similar to what people feel when we make art?
I don't think so. There have been studies that indicate that elephants have some self-consciousness, but I don't think they have the kind of self-consciousness that we do, where there's something in the back of your mind about, this is going to be great.
I really had a great day today. I really knocked that one out of the park. They don't think
right,
that, yeah.
Right.
So what do you think they think?
I think they don't have the opportunity to just roam as far as they want to, or to have the social structure that they would have in the wild. And this is something for them to do. They're interacting with the person that they live with, and they perhaps want to please that person to some extent, but they're also, I think, just experimenting with what happens.
That's also one of the great motivations for humans to make art, because we're bored, to read or to go to a museum or anything. It's a way out of our situation.
It's one way to focus on something that's a little bit outside yourself and brings the best out of you if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm. Elephants are one of the stars of the animal kingdom, and they probably survive as a species only because our interest in them is slightly greater than our lust for ivory. But there are a lot of animals that are not as interesting to us and who die off with hardly a mention. So I want to end this podcast with another poem of yours that we have recorded. It's called Elegy for the Quagga, and it was in Poetry Magazine in October of 2008. Before we hear it, can you tell us what the quagga was?
I think I read that the quagga is a subspecies of zebra. It was a very stubborn animal, about small horse size, that was only striped on its hindquarters, I think. And I guess they were just shot for sport.
And they died out in the 1880s, and the poem begins with Krakatoa, the volcano in Indonesia that exploded in 1883 and killed tens of thousands of people. Krakatoa is unconnected with the quagga, except in your poem. What's the connection in your mind?
At some point, I stumbled over the dates and realized how close they were.
Mm-hmm.
And one disaster was out of our control, and one disaster on a smaller scale was one that we caused.
So here's the poem.
Elegy for the Quagga. Krakatoa split with a blinding noise and raised from gutted, steaming rock a pulverized black sky over water walls that swiftly fell on Java and Sumatra. 15 days before, in its cage in Amsterdam, the last known member of Equus quagga, the southernmost subspecies of zebra, died. Most of the wild ones, not wild enough, grazing near the Cape of Good Hope, had been shot and skinned and roasted by white hunters. When a spider walked on cooling Krakatoa's skin, no quagga walked anywhere, while seeds pitched by long winds onto newborn fields burst open and rooted, perhaps some thistle flourished on the quagga's discarded innards. The fractured island greened and hummed again. Handsome zebras tossed their heads in zoos on hired safari planes. Who needs to hear a quagga's voice, or see the warm hide twitch away a fly, see the neck turn, curving its cream and chestnut stripes that run down to plain dark haunches and plain white legs? A kind of horse, less picturesque than a dodo. Still, we mourn what we mourn, even if, when it sank to its irreplaceable knees, when its unique throat closed behind a sigh, No dust rose to redden a whole year's sunsets. No one unwittingly busy 2,000 miles away jumped at the sound. No ashes rained on ships in the merciless sea.
That was Elegy for the Quagga. And Sarah, I think a lot of our listeners will have heard about this, but we are apparently in the midst of the fifth great extinction of animals, according to biologists. And some people estimate by the end of this century, half of all species will be extinct. And poetry can't do anything about that, obviously. But your poem really gives it an emotional shape for me. And it had a deep effect on me when I first read it. Is this something that keeps you up at night? Is this something that you think about a lot?
I do think about it a lot. It's hard to keep me up at night, but but ever since I was young, I realized that that was one of the things that was going on. They would teach us about pollution, and they would teach us about drugs, and sort of concomitant disasters was that the animals were threatened. I wasn't aware until I read about the quagga that animals in the present could become extinct. I thought that was a dinosaur thing.
Mm.
And so it was pretty alarming to think that these things would not be there the way it seemed they had always been there.
Yeah, it's extremely alarming, and it's according to scientists, it's at least as alarming as global warming for the future of humanity. It's a very big, gigantic, bleak problem. How does a poet deal with this without falling into the utter despair that most of us are going to be falling into the next 15, 20 years? How do you deal with this?
I wonder if poets are slightly defended against utter despair just because they're creating something and are able to escape into that periodically.
Like the elephants, huh?
That's right. That's right. Otherwise, I think you take your life outside the writing of the poetry and the reading of the poetry and try to accomplish something that way, even if it's just writing a check, because at this point the problem is so enormous that it takes organizations to cope with it, unless you're one of those very special people who just flies to Africa and starts living with the gorillas or something.
Yeah, we're not going to be doing that, you and I don't think.
No.
Sarah Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Lindsay's latest book is Twigs and Knuckle Bones, published by Copper Canyon Press. You can read about a dozen of her poems on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where if you do a search for animals, all kinds of interesting poems pop up. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org for poetry off the shelf. I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.